From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
I want to say directly to anyone who feels threatened today, you are safe in Boston. If necessary, we'll use City Hall itself to shelter and protect anyone who's targeted unjustly.
Reaction to President Trump's executive orders on immigration. We'll talk about that and more on The Week in Review. And we'll hear from a Somali refugee family who've arrived in New England just as the Trump administration moves to freeze refugee admissions. Also today,
some of you might not want to hear what I have to say about the problems that still remain. As long as I've got breath, I am going to say it over and over again.
Legendary Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall there. A one-man production at Watertown's New Rep Theater puts Marshall's complex life on stage. That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And yes, it is Friday, everyone, which means it's time for The Week in Review, beginning today with President Donald Trump's executive actions on immigration.
A nation without borders is not a nation. Beginning today, the United States of America gets back control of its borders, gets back its borders.
And among the orders Trump signed, one that calls for withholding of federal funds from so-called sanctuary cities, here's a reaction from Chelsea City Manager Tom Ambrosino.
We're not changing our policies as a result of this presidential order. Treating everyone here, documented or undocumented, with dignity and respect is part of our core values in this city, and those are not for sale.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh also said that Boston wouldn't be, quote, intimidated by the president's executive orders, saying that if necessary, he'd offer City Hall as a shelter for any immigrant targeted by federal officials. WEEI's Pete Shepard pushed back.
It sounds like you let these illegals into to go crash at City Hall in six minutes.
Well, joining us to talk about this and all the week's news, today we've got Lou Murray. He's a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. He's also a member of the National Catholic Advisory Committee for Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Lou, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
It's great to have you back. Also with us today, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor as well. Renee, it's great to have you back as well.
Good to see you.
All right, well, let me just get first quick thoughts from you both about the things we've been hearing all week from various Massachusetts officials about their reaction to the president's signing of these executive orders, specifically about the move to potentially withhold federal funds from sanctuary cities. And Renee, let's start with you.
Well, I have to say, I was rather impressed by how quickly Mayor Walsh came out and had a press conference and addressed this. I think it's important for mayors to take a stand on this. You know, in a way, they're kind of being coerced and threatened. If you don't do what I want, I'm going to take away these federal funds. It's impressive that mayors have stepped up instantly and said, we're not changing our policy. This is the way we operate. This is what we're going to continue to do. So it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds going forward. But it was very impressive that mayors wasted no time in letting the president know that they're going to stick to their guns on this.
And Lou, I'm going to come to you in just a second. But since Renee mentioned Mayor Walsh, let's just hear a little bit more from the mayor. This is him on Wednesday promising to protect any person in the country illegally or undocumented, or that's living in Boston, I should say. And he said the U.S. Constitution is on Boston's side.
I want to say directly to anyone who feels threatened today, you are safe in Boston. We will do everything lawful in our power to protect you. If necessary, we will use City Hall itself to shelter and protect anyone who's targeted unjustly.
Lou, your thoughts?
Finley Peter Dutton, Mr. Dooley, said that the U.S. Supreme Court reads the election results. I don't think that anything that Mr. Trump is doing right now will not be upheld by courts, and that the cities and towns that want to play this game of treating citizens like second-class citizens and treating illegal aliens like first-class citizens are going to feel the sting of the whip of the federal budget.
Okay, so how is it that, I'll ask you both, how is it that you see Walsh as treating citizens as second-class citizens when he says about using City Hall to shelter, in his words, anyone who's targeted unjustly?
Well, if you and I had a warrant out from another city or town and we were arrested in Boston, we would get shipped to that next city or town to face that warrant. And it's my understanding that in a sanctuary city, the ICE, which is the immigration enforcement arm, lets the city know that there are crimes that this illegal alien has committed and that there is a detainer on that immigrant, and the city should hold them and they should face the crimes in the other jurisdiction. That's not happening with sanctuary cities. So why would a citizen be treated differently than a non-citizen?
Renee, your thoughts, your reaction?
Well, I mean, I think it's a complicated issue. I mean, I think, you know, I think once you get into an area where you're talking about sort of rounding people up and putting them someplace to then, you know, take them out of the area where they live, I just think we're getting into a really slippery slope and a really scary place. You know, I really respect the fact that, again, that Mayor Walsh says we're not doing that. I believe his number was 28% of residents in the city are undocumented. And not all of them are criminals. Now, if you're criminalizing them simply because they're here, that's its own thing. But I think that the idea that simply rounding people up, and in most cases we know who we're talking about rounding up. He's talking about, for the most part, immigrants who are from Mexico and from other you know, countries of that nature. You know, you're not talking about Irish immigrants. He's not talking about Chinese immigrants. And that's the problem. The idea of it is racist to begin with, but also rounding people up and deciding, well, okay, we're getting you out. No, I think cities have to push back.
But Renee, let me just ask you. I mean, part of this is a long-running debate here in Massachusetts. You know, I mean, under Governor Romney, when the secure communities idea was launched, I mean, that's when we started hearing these cities and towns pushing back. But what about just the basic expectation that it makes sense to a lot of people that local law enforcement, in cases in which there is a criminal warrant, for example, out on someone, if they detain that person for something else, that they should work with federal authorities in terms of having a more seamless cooperation between local and federal authorities in cases where there is a criminal warrant on the person?
Well, we're talking about a criminal warrant or people who don't have criminal warrants.
Well, I mean, I think in a lot of cities and towns, they've said some have even said even if there's a criminal warrant, they may not do anything. Others have said that yes, they would. They would detain the person for ICE.
I mean,
secure communities refers to people that are being charged with a crime. And under the Obama administration, it was rape, murder, and serious crimes. One of the things that President Trump has done is expanded that list of serious crimes to the crimes that are hurting people right in our own neighborhoods. Crimes like the crime that killed Matthew Denise, which was OUI, and the fraud and Social Security theft.
Yeah, in the Denise case, we spoke with Matthew's parents, and that person was supposed to have been deported. That's true. But let me ask you, Lou, I think the fear that a lot of people have is that we could move towards a kind of society where just by virtue of perhaps looking like you're someone, and I put that in quotes, like looking like you're someone who may not have the proper documentation, that the expectation would be for law enforcement to start asking you. And that's what I think what the mayor was saying by when he was saying he was concerned about protecting anyone, again, in his words, who was targeted unjustly.
I don't buy it. I don't think we don't have enough space to hold every single person that's here illegally. What Donald Trump has done as president from day one is say, I'm going after the criminals. And the criminal illegal aliens are going to be deported and the streets are going to be made safe. And I think there are a lot of people in a lot of illegal alien communities that would be delighted to see the fentanyl dealers go.
Mm. Well, I want to go ahead, Renee.
You know, I just the thought I just have in sort of listening to this idea that, you know, the streets will be safer without these people. I also think, you know, we already have plenty of profiling. You know, we have too much profiling. I don't really think we need more.
Mm. Well, I want to play some tape that sort of, again, runs the gamut of responses to the president's executive orders that he signed this week. This first one, it comes, again, from an interaction that Mayor Walsh had on WEEI's Kirk and Callahan. He actually called in after his statements earlier in the week were getting a lot of criticism on EEI, and they were fulminating about how the mayor said he'd allow kids, perhaps, to shelter in his city hall office, and Mayor Walsh took offense to that and told them, hey guys, stop being a wise guy, and here's what happened.
I'm not being a wise guy.
How? You just said kids, and I said kids. How am I being a wise guy?
Because the way you're framing it all here.
Framing what? You said kids, and I said kids.
What are you yelling for? I'm not yelling.
Framing what? Framing what?
I'm not getting mad about.
I'm not getting mad at all. Who said? You said kids, and I said kids.
You sound it.
So adults will not be allowed in, just kids, right?
How about homeless veterans? Since they came knocking on your door and said they need a place to stay. How about that?
So I wanted to play that because of what happened there at the end about the asking about homeless veterans. On the other end of things, we have got some tape from Chelsea City Manager Tom Ambrosino, and he pointed out a concern about what might happen if federal funds are withheld from cities like Chelsea. And he talked about one federal grant that Chelsea gets. They just received it from the U.S. Department of Justice, and its entire purpose, this federal grant, is to help the city target and, in fact, reduce youth violence.
One of the things that grant is helping us support is a youth worker whose focus really is undocumented youth who don't have strong ties yet to the country, to ensure that we're providing sufficient support so that they don't turn to gangs and otherwise will turn to existing social service organizations for the assistance and the encouragement that they're looking for.
So Lou, respond to that. I mean, the Chelsea City Manager is saying, hey, this could actually make everyone less safe if we can't fund these kind of programs.
Well, it's circular reasoning. If we're able to get MS-13 off the street because we can deport their criminal hierarchy, we can stop their recruiting in the Somerville Public Schools, in the Everett Public Schools, in the Chelsea Public Schools, and in the East Boston Public Schools, where it's been documented.
Hmm. So, do you assume every member of MS-13 is here illegally?
No, I don't, but I would say that a good proportion of them are.
And again, I can't support the idea that we're going to harm communities in deep ways with programs they have for the elderly and programs they have for veterans by doing this. It would be very different if the president had said, look, we need to figure out a way to deal with this problem. What can we do? How do we work together on this? But that's not the tact he's taking. And I just think it's the wrong way of going about it.
Well, let's go back to the tape on the Jerry Callahan show. Mm-hmm. Jerry's a hell of a guy. I used to play basketball with him up at the Y in Lowell. And I think he was right to challenge the mayor to say, hey, do you know who Matthew Denise is? And the mayor couldn't even name the victim or understand who the victim was. It was an Aleppo moment for Mayor Walsh. I think also that in all of this with Mayor Walsh, where he's getting all this national attention and certainly a lot of regional attention on the television, he's playing to the far left, and he's thinking about his reelection, and he's thinking about Tito Jackson. And so you're trying to see him out left Tito. And then the second group of people that the mayor is speaking to is a Suffolk County jury pool, because he's worried about a labor indictment.
Well, I'm gonna
on a federal level.
I'm going to ask you about that in a second. But, you know, in that, and the end of the, we didn't play the whole interaction on EEI, but, you know, how he was being told about, hey, what about homeless vets? We should say, though, that the mayor did come back and say, look, the city of Boston has housed 700 homeless vets recently, and they have a plan to end chronic homelessness for vets by 2018. I mean, we can get into a lot of detail about particular exchanges, and obviously we will have many weeks to come to continue to explore this immigration question. But Lou, since you did point to this labor probe that Mayor Walsh could be facing, let me just give a little bit of background for that and get both of your quick thoughts on that, because he is facing some increased pressure in the federal investigation of City Hall surrounding Boston Calling. That was when two city officials were charged with extortion for allegedly forcing the music festival to hire union stagehands. And we've got new federal court filings that find that Walsh participated in at least two meetings with the concert promoter where that was allegedly extorted by these aides. So
let me turn to Renee here for a second. But has one of the aides been convicted?
No, I don't think so. Not yet. I'll double check on that. But Renee, let me your thoughts on what this might mean for Mayor Walsh.
You know, it's not going away. It's sort of hanging over him like this cloud. And the longer it goes on, the more it seems it gets murkier and murkier. Murkier as to what his role was in it. So yeah, I do think that he has reasons to not necessarily want to distract people or change it. But, you know, he does want to sort of reinforce the things that could help him get reelected. People don't want a lot of scandals and that kind of thing sort of hanging over their mayor. And, you know, it's unfortunate that this keeps blossoming and just, again, not going away for him.
Yeah. So, Lou, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think you have to drop the word alleged. I believe someone has been convicted in this matter. And I think that the fact that the mayor was at two of the meetings that were central to the prosecution is a big deal.
Okay, well, I'm going to actually ask our producers to double fact check on that, because before the end of this conversation, we will get the exact right answer on that, because we need to get that right.
And I like Marty, and I believe every man has a right to the presumption of innocence, so I want to say that.
Well, I'm also sorry that I don't have the answer to your question on the tip of my tongue right now. Listeners, we'll get to the bottom of that about the investigation into members of Mayor Walsh's administration. But let's move to another big story that happened this week before we run out of too much time here. And that was in the fact that on Saturday, more than 175,000 people took part in what's called the Boston Women's March. Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke on Saturday, promising the huge crowd that, in her words, she'd fight against President Donald Trump's agenda.
Hundreds of thousands of people in Boston, in Washington, and across this country. We are in marches to say we are fighting back. That's who we are.
How significant? 175,000 people?
I was one of them. It was quite the crowd. I mean, it was, you know, for throughout the week, they expected 25,000, then it went to 60, then it went to 80, you know, and by the time Saturday came around, it was 175,000 people. It was rather extraordinary. There were lots of complaints about sort of who was there and what causes were being dealt with, but the bottom line is that, you know, for a good chunk of Saturday, there were 175,000 people out there for one reason, and that was to protest the policies of Donald Trump.
Lou, your thoughts?
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration, and I took my nieces and nephews into the Smithsonian Museum, American History Wing, and we had to fight our way through the crowds that were at the Washington March. I say, you know, it was a great learning experience. I was able to say to my nieces and nephews, hey, these people are here safely demonstrating on our streets why they don't like Donald Trump. And they asked me, they're young, 8, 9, 11, and 13. They said, why didn't they organize like this for the election? And I said, out of the mouths of babes.
Hmm. I don't know, 65 million people, what, 120,000 overall? 120 million?
Yes, but we are a democratic republic, and you must win your divisions to earn your electoral votes.
So you're not supposed to protest?
No, I'm not saying that. I praise the protest. I'm just saying
they're not protesting the election or the result. They're protesting against the president.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that they're not questioning the validity of the election.
Unlike the president.
The outcome.
Who's questioning the popular vote?
But
so.
the point that those kids made was if they had put all the tenth of the energy into these protests as they had put into the election, maybe we would have been celebrating President Hillary Clinton last Friday.
Well, so I mean, not that we can sort of litigate over the actual outcome of the election here, but let me just ask you both. I mean, we've got a march going on in Washington today. As organizers call the March for Life. And we're talking about the one that happened here in Boston and in other places around the country and around the world on Saturday. I mean, do either of you, both of you, feel like we're going to see a lot more of this, that people, you know, whatever their perspective is regarding the president or various policies, taking to the streets more than we've seen in the past couple of years?
Absolutely.
Oh, I do, too. I mean, I think, especially with regard to the anti-abortion movement and the pro-life movement, It's a youth movement. There are 1,100 chapters of Student for Life on college campuses across America. There's 200 student chapters of Planned Parenthood.
Mm. And, you know, on the other side, there are people who feel threatened. You know, the LGBTQ community, women, people of color. You know, there's a lot of different groups out there right now. And, you know, they're kind of focused. You know, they have an agenda. And the agenda is to hold the president to account.
Although, there, you know, one of the criticisms of Saturday's march is that perhaps there weren't as many people of color there as could have been, should have been. Maybe, you know, that we've got some tape here from Nina Odom, who was speaking to WBUR on Saturday, saying, hey, maybe the march didn't actually do enough to be inclusive on issues of race.
I'm surprised that there aren't as many black and brown people as I would like to have seen. And I wonder where we all are.
I mean, I do think that there were people who felt that this was a kind of feminist movement, and there's always been a holdover from the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s, where a lot of women of color and lesbians felt left out. They felt this was a white woman's movement. I still do think there are echoes of that today. However, I think what all of these groups are going to have to understand is that they have a common goal. Mm. You know, yes, there's Black Lives Matter, and yes, there's reproductive rights, but there's a common goal, and it's to make sure that the president hears their concerns.
Yeah. So one more thing we want to talk about this week, and that is the governor's State of the Commonwealth address. But before we forget, Lou, you had asked about or brought in the federal probes into members of Mayor Walsh's administration. I've got the fact here now. So the two members of his administration that have been indicted, Timothy Sullivan and Kenneth Brissett, there have been no convictions there yet. Those investigations are ongoing. Those federal investigations. They have the one conviction that has happened was from a former Teamsters official, Mark Harrington. He was sentenced to 2 years on probation, and that happened in December of last year, December 15th, 2016. So not directly associated with the mayor's administration.
I apologize. I'm getting labor racketeering confused.
Okay, but we got the facts out there straight right now. Let's talk for a minute before we run out of time about the governor's State of the Commonwealth address. I want to play a particular moment that came at the very, very end of his speech where he talked about Massachusetts' relationship with Washington. The governor went to a lot of pains to talk about bipartisanship and cooperation in this state. And then he said that, you know, wedge issues were great for making headlines, but he said they're not a true measure of success.
Success is measured by what we accomplish together. Our obligation to the people we serve is too important to place politics and partisanship before progress and results. And the changes in Washington don't change this powerful obligation. Our job remains the same, that is, to represent Massachusetts to Washington and not Washington to Massachusetts.
So that was one of the biggest applause lines the governor had that night. Renee, your thoughts on what Charlie Baker's trying to say there?
You know, I think Charlie Baker's in this odd position right now. I mean, he was, you know, against Trump during the election. Then he decided, okay, he's now president. I have to pivot and make sense of all this. But, you know, he's also has to be the governor of Massachusetts. And some of the issues that he's going to support are not the same issues that Donald Trump is supporting. So I think he just wanted to be very clear about where he stood and where he thinks the Commonwealth has to continue to stand, you know, in terms of Washington.
Lou, your thoughts?
Yeah, my thoughts are, you know, there was a lot of coded language in there to the Democrats in the legislature. I mean, it's kind of the Baker Kabuki Theater. If you know what I mean.
Those are the folks he has to work with, though, here in
the state. Those are the folks he has to work with. But he's working with them very well. He's given them a big pay raise. He knew it was coming. He said, I'm going to get out of town and go to the inauguration of a president that I didn't support, that I verbally derided on numerous occasions, and let them have their hearings, and I'm not going to make a big kerfuffle about it. Matter of fact, I'm not even going to say anything about it until after they take their first vote. And for a fiscal conservative guy like myself, I'm a little disappointed in the governor. Hmm. And I think a lot of other grassroots rank and file Republicans are too. I mean, this is a huge pay raise. Does anybody in Massachusetts think that we should carry the moniker of Or the accolade of the highest paid lawmakers in the nation?
Did he not veto that pay raise? Did he not announce that today?
No, he said he's gonna veto it, but he didn't make a squawk about it until after the first vote was taken.
Yeah, well, so but I mean, he might actually go ahead and veto it though.
The votes are there to pass it overwhelmingly. It's a done deal.
But at least he has to veto it, right? I mean, again, he's working with the Democratic
legislature. You don't seem impressed by that.
Hey. If I was sitting in the corner office, I'd have had 50,000, or maybe I would have had 175,000, I mean, down on the common to stop that pay raise.
Oh, it looks like Governor Baker actually did veto the bill today, but like you said, the votes are there for it to pass. You know, hey, I have one more question for you, Lou, because I'd be really grateful to get your perspective on this, because throughout this week in review, we sort of talked a lot about different Massachusetts leaders and their reactions to Washington, to President Trump, and things that he signed this week, and I'm wondering what you think about how Cardinal Sean O'Malley should be treating this moment. And I mean, you're on the Catholic Advisory Board for Trump and Pence, because on the one hand, you know, there's the March for Life going on in Washington right now, and of course the Archdiocese has been very much opposed to abortion forever. But on the other hand, we started talking about immigration, and there was also, you know, there are likely to be executive orders on refugees, mm-hmm. and the Archdiocese has, and the Vatican has been very supportive of refugees,
right?
Which would be in opposition to what the Trump administration wants. So what would you like to hear from Cardinal O'Malley on these things?
Well, I'd like to see Cardinal O'Malley follow the lead of the Bishop of New Hampshire, who has been very active in speaking out on one of the number one crimes that you don't hear about a lot, but concerns me and should concern a lot of feminists, is human trafficking. Human trafficking goes hand in hand with illegal alien crime and illegal alien drug dealing. There have been 70 cases of human trafficking in New Hampshire. So I wonder how many we have down here in Massachusetts. But, you know, I think the Cardinal will be well served to follow the example of the Holy Father, Pope Francis, and take a wait-and-see attitude towards Donald Trump's leadership. I would note that the Catechism of the Catholic Church states very clearly that a nation has a right and a duty to its citizens to have juridical conditions for immigration, and that the object of immigration is to have people come into and become part of your civilization, and to so that there would be accord and concord and justice.
Yeah, and in addition, though, I mean, the Vatican has oftentimes been, well, I mean, I think the Archdiocese have been supportive of parishes using churches as literal shelters for refugees, right? I mean, but let me ask you.
I think it's a misreading of the assimilation that's called for in the Catechism.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm not. I'm not an expert in Catholic catechism.
Nor am I.
Amateur theologian at best, a former altar boy.
But Renee, let me ask you. I mean, because I asked that question in terms of, we've been talking about politicians, but obviously faith leaders across in the state have a pretty big voice too. What could they add to this conversation as Massachusetts continues to move forward under a new Trump administration?
Well, I think they have to add to the conversation. I think in some cases they've had a bit of a wait and see attitude as well. But, you know, a lot of these groups are involved in, you know, social justice work, and they have to see how this administration is going to affect the work that they're trying to do and the people that they serve. I think if they feel that the administration is making decisions that are hurting their parishioners, that are hurting their community, I think they're going to be quite vocal in what's happening. Hmm. You know, it hasn't happened yet, but again, it's still week one.
One more quick thing, and we'll do our hubbubs.
Yeah,
sure.
One more quick thing is that one way that the church could work with the administration is to get the UN out of vetting which refugees go where. Here in Massachusetts, we have a large Syrian Catholic and Orthodox population that's been here for years, and they would like to take in some Syrian Catholic and Orthodox refugees. But do you know how many Christian and Catholic and Orthodox refugees have come out of Syria in the last 2 years?
To Massachusetts?
No, to the United States. 16.
Well, we have just enough time This is like a hard turn here to our hubbubs, but I feel like we need it. And that's those stories that maybe didn't get to the top of the fold or didn't get the kind of attention that we think they deserve. And Renee, let's start with you.
Well, I'm going to bump the legendary Paradise Rock Club is hosting a women's power yoga event, which, like last week's Women's March, is meant to inspire people and get them together and build a sense of community. And the money that they raise from that is going to go to a charity suggested by the registrants. So if you're around the Paradise Rock Club, if you like power yoga, if you want to support your community and have this sense of unity, this is the place to be.
Power yoga at the Paradise.
Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m.
Lou, your hubbub?
My hubbub is going on right now, and I canceled my flight to Washington, D.C. so I could be here with you, Meghna. It's the March for Life, and it's there are events all over the country. It's people that are anti-abortion who want to stand up and say that every human life from the moment of conception is a unique human individual with DNA that deserves the right to breathe free and have a opportunity to live in the United States and pursue happiness.
Now, I would like to note that both of your hubbubs had to do with the peaceful and powerful exercising of rights that we have to political speech in this country. I'm going to take it down about 50 notches and talk about Big Macs.
Yeah.
I can agree with that.
I'm going to lowbrow this hubbub because there was a story about how next Tuesday, so in a couple days from now, in Kenmore Square, at the Kenmore Square McDonald's, there's going to be a Big Mac ATM. That's going to be given. I don't even know how this is going to work, but they're going to be giving away Big Macs for free for between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. It's a high-tech vending machine. I'm going to presume that the meat gets cooked somehow. You have to, in exchange for getting the free Big Mac, you got to give them your Twitter handle, and then McDonald's will tweet for you, check out the new Big Mac. They're saying it's a fun and progressive way to get people engaged with Big Macs, I guess. But okay. We also...
Yeah, I love it. You know what I loved about that story was that most of the young people today don't know what's in a Big Mac, unlike Renee and I, who both know that it's...
To all beef patty, special sauce,
lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions,
on a sesame seed bun. So,
however, I've never eaten a Big Mac.
Oh, my gosh.
I used to eat them a lot as a kid.
Never had one.
I mean, the subtext of this story is if a machine can vend you Big Macs, like, you know, the machines may be doing a lot more than that in regular McDonald's in the future. So
yeah.
I guess I got
to give a shout out to my buddy Vincent Spadea, who helped with that project.
Oh, really?
He's a McDonald's
Lou,
man.
Lou, you're a well-connected man. So Lou Murray, contributor to WBR's Cognoscenti and member of the National Catholic Advisory Committee for Trump and Pence. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
And Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and also regular contributor to WBUR. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Megan.
And anyone who changes their plans to be on Radio Boston, move stuff around, I always appreciate it. Thank you both. Have a great weekend. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Later this afternoon, President Donald Trump is expected to issue an executive order freezing all refugee resettlement in the United States for up to 4 months. The president is also expected to order a review of the vetting process for refugees coming here from predominantly Muslim countries. And the executive order could have major implications, including for one newly arrived Somali family in Lowell. WBUR Shannon Dooling has their story.
The three Ahmed sisters from Somalia huddled on a couch with their mother in the lobby of a busy office. Each woman was wearing a brightly colored headscarf and winter jacket, and each clutched a plastic bag carrying their personal documents. They are the most recent refugees to be welcomed at the International Institute of New England's Lowell Resettlement Office. And with President Trump's refugee restrictions hanging in the balance, they are likely the last Somali family to enter the state for some time.
My mom and dad fled from the conflict in Mogadishu.
24-year-old Hawa and her twin sister Mona were only 4 months old when their parents fled for Kenya. Hawa retells her mother Fatima's story of why they left in 1993 amid the Somali civil war.
She said that it was like a conflict all over the country. People were killing each other, like tribes, different tribes were killing each other. Whenever they see you, they kill you. And they even used to come in the houses to rape the girls and kill them. So they had to move.
The youngest daughter, Asha, was born in Kenya, where the girls grew up, went to school, and learned English. Still, they all very much consider themselves Somali. When asked about their father, one of the girls says she watched him die in 2006 from an asthma attack. She says the family didn't have enough money for a new inhaler. After beginning the refugee application process in Kenya 6 years ago, the family arrived in Manchester, New Hampshire, only a few days ago. Hawa and Mona say it barely felt real, like a dream come true. And then, Hawa says, as soon as they got off the plane, they saw the news about the executive orders on an airport television.
Even tears were filled up in my eyes because I felt very bad for others. They're also, they have more expectation. Some were even told where they are going, which state they are going. And if they stop all these things, it's going to be very painful. I just have a very sincere request to the president that he should drop out that idea. That's all.
Hawa says they know many fellow refugees in Kenya who are in the final phases of their application process. She says her aunt and cousin, who live in a refugee camp in Kampala, Uganda, had only one more interview to complete before they were hoping to meet them in Massachusetts. Now, they're not sure what will happen to them.
I couldn't sleep last night. I was just thinking about them. And she has been in the process for so long, and we want, if you can help her.
We work with these folks. We know when they talk about their families and brothers and sisters and parents that they want to bring to the United States. And we know how heartbreaking it is for this whole process to happen.
Jeff Thielman is president of the International Institute, the resettlement agency that brought the Ahmed family to Lowell. He says there are countless stories like theirs of families going through the proper procedures, trying for years to reunite, and now being told to wait longer.
So they want to, and they're doing everything right to come to the United States. They're doing everything they're supposed to do to come here, but there's this obstacle to getting here.
Of course, proponents of Trump's restrictions say there are not necessarily enough obstacles to being resettled in the U.S. Jessica Vaughn is director of policy studies for the Center of Immigration Studies, a group that supports limiting immigration. Vaughn says it's about time the refugee resettlement system had an overhaul.
The point is to make sure that we are not unnecessarily putting ourselves at risk or assisting ISIS, which has promised to infiltrate the refugee flow, by being reckless and going forward with a program that needs a review. I think that the administration is going to restart some of these programs, but they want to be confident that they can do so safely.
Okay. Do you have any questions for me?
No.
So the same thing with your mother's case. I will issue the emergency food stamp for you.
A few blocks away from the resettlement office in Lowell, the Ahmed sisters and their mother each applied for nutritional assistance. After answering a series of questions and showing their documents, they each qualified for 1 month's worth of emergency food stamps. The government employee processing their application told the family that he was also a refugee from Cambodia. He typed in their information and printed out their paperwork. "Welcome to America," he said.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Her story is the first in a new ongoing WBUR series called Mass Impact, The Trump Effect. We'll be taking a look at the impact of the president's policies on Massachusetts. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In June of 1991, Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall stepped down from the nation's highest court. The legendary lawyer and first Black Supreme Court justice was 83 years old then, and at his retirement announcement, a reporter asked Marshall whether he thought Martin Luther King's famous line, "Free at last, thank God Almighty we are free at last rang true for him.
Well, I'm not free. All I know is that years ago, when I was a youngster, a Pullman porter told me that he had been in every city in this country. He was sure. And he had never been in any city in the United States where he had to put his hand up in front of his face to find out he was a Negro. I agree with it.
That's Justice Thurgood Marshall in 1991. At the beginning of the one-man play Thurgood, on now at the New Repertory Theater in Watertown, this is the Thurgood Marshall we meet, the towering figure near the end of his life, after a quarter century on the Supreme Court and a quarter century as a history-making civil rights lawyer before that. Marshall in the play looks back on his own life in much the same way the real Justice did in that clip you just heard, and by looking back, he's introducing himself to a whole new audience. Joining us today to talk more about it is actor Johnny Lee Davenport. He plays Thurgood Marshall in the new Reps production. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
It is fantastic to have you. Also with us on the line from Washington, D.C. is playwright George Stevens, Jr. Mr. Stevens, welcome to you.
And I thank you very much.
It's great to have you as well. Johnny Lee Davenport, let me start with you. It's a one-man play. You embody Thurgood Marshall in every way possible. What does it mean to you to do this play now?
Well, this is my first one-man show, and to, first of all, George, Mr. Stevens, thank you for this opportunity to say these words and to tell this story in the way that you've written it. It's fantastic. I really, really want to say thank you. And I have to say my wife is a big fan.
But to
tell this story, and to realize how relative it is right now is just mind-boggling. The connections that are made. For instance, our new president may have the opportunity to appoint 4 Supreme Court justices during his first 4 years. And in the play, you find out that Nixon did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just phenomenal.
Well, George Stevens Jr., let me ask you. Thurgood premiered on Broadway back in 2008, and I believe its first performances happened even before Barack Obama began his first term. So what inspired you to write a one-man play about Thurgood Marshall?
I had, years before, directed and written a mini-series for television called Separate But Equal that was the story of Brown versus the Board of Education, and Sidney Poitier played Thurgood Marshall. And some years after that, I was having dinner with Sidney and his wife Joanna and my wife Liz in Los Angeles, and I asked Sidney what he was up to. And Sidney, in that rather stately way of his, said, "It has been 40 years since I did Raisin in the Sun. I want to go back to Broadway." And I don't know where it came from, but I said, "Well, why don't I write a play about Thurgood Marshall?" And I sentenced myself. And then about 8 months later, I gave it to him in Sydney. We had lived in the same building and had apartments in Los Angeles. And Sydney would come down and read it and said, "I'm moving into a house and I'm going to learn the play." And a little while later, he invited me up for lunch. And he said, "I am 75 years old. I cannot learn your play." So that provided an opportunity for many fine actors.
Yeah. Well, and one of them who's sitting across the table from me here now today. So you mentioned Brown versus Board. Of course, that is the 1954 ruling that desegregated American schools, the landmark case that most people may remember Justice Marshall for. But, he was obviously a very powerful legal figure for the NAACP even before that. Johnny Lee Davenport, tell me, how do you get into the mind, the rhythm of a man like Thurgood Marshall on stage?
The words are there. And all I have to do is honor the language, honor the words. What I've learned is that Thurgood had such an immense wit and intellect and sense of humor. And so from this play that is full of facts and full of dates and full of, I'll call it, legalese, it's distilled down to a man who has gone through so many changes in his life, who has confronted so many obstacles to forward his passion.
Yeah.
It starts out where he's able to watch Negro prisoners being beaten in a Northwest Baltimore police station. And that has stayed with him. And he says at the end, that is why I've done everything in my power to protect the civil rights of every American citizen. Hmm. And this passion, he wouldn't let go of this burning fire. But I endeavor to bring the humanity of the man, and it's not hard because the words are there,
mm-hmm.
and it's inherent in the speech, and I honor language. I love language,
yeah.
And the words I get to say are just brilliant.
Well, George,
that sense of humor of Thurgood's is a blessing, isn't it, Mr. Davenport?
It certainly is.
Well, George Stevens, tell us more about that, because I think, you know, people obviously remember Marshall for his legal victories, but his life away from the court is also part of the play. How did you weave that in?
Well, there's a great deal of record around of his, you know, his what he's said over the years, and you know, weaving that together. You know, I think one reason for me wanting to do the play was I have great respect for Dr. King and all that he achieved and what he went through to achieve it, but I felt that Thurgood is under-recognized in that area, because without Thurgood Marshall, there is no Dr. King, because
right.
Thurgood Marshall was the architect, as he used to say, using the law like a weapon. And it was he created that foundation using the law to make possible the civil rights movement.
Mm. Which is what's even more interesting to me, because in the play, there's a moment, at least a couple, but the one in particular I'm thinking of, where we actually see a slightly less assured side of Thurgood Marshall. Because from the history books, you think of him as a man who met only with success
right.
because of his towering achievements in the court. But there's a moment in the play where he talks about getting interrupted by judges.
He was interrupted 43 times while making a statement in the first Supreme Court hearing of the Brown case,
right.
and it rattled him. He says he gets unhinged by their questions. He says the most important goddamn case of the century, and what do? I get unhinged by their questions.
What do you think it does for the audience to see that less assured side?
I think it lets them know that he's not a man of stone. He's not this icon for civil rights. We called him Mr. Civil Rights, but he was just a man who had a passion and a need to help people.
Well, I want to play one.
And the odds of him of his side winning the Brown case were formidable, and he felt that he'd lost the key opportunity.
That's right.
Of course, he went on to win, right?
Yeah.
I want to play one more piece of tape from Justice Marshall himself, actually. This is from 1988, and he spoke to a group called the Judicial Council. They had given him a ward. And really, you hear his passion, which never waned, of continuing the efforts of the civil rights movement.
We claim that we have made great advances. A lot of people do. I mean, I'm in the group that doesn't believe that. And some of you might not want to hear what I have to say about the problems that still remain. Why, when you get in high office, you do that? Well, I'll tell you why. As long as I've got breath, I am going to say it. And I'm going to repeat it over and over again.
It's Justice Thurgood Marshall speaking in 1988. We've just got a couple minutes left here. Johnny Lee Davenport, this play is being performed at a very pivotal moment in the American story. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us about I feel a sense of optimism in the play near the end that may be particularly moving to audiences now.
Yeah, I'd like to do the final poem by Langston Hughes, some of that.
Yeah.
And it'll give you an indication of the hope that is built into the play. It is a play that has hope built into it.
Because Marshall and Langston Hughes knew each other.
They were school, yes. Schoolmates. They went to Lincoln College together. Oh, let America be America again. the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that is mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain must bring back our mighty dream again. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet, I swear this oath, America will be.
Well, that is Johnny Lee Davenport reading Langston Hughes, which closes the play, the one-man play Thurgood, which is on stage now at the New Rep Theater in Watertown. Johnny Lee Davenport plays Thurgood Marshall. An honor and a pleasure to have you.
Thank you
so much for coming in today.
Thank you. How was that, George? Was that all right?
I think you're doing well, Johnny.
Well, George Stevens Jr., playwright of Thurgood, thank you as well. And that's it for today and this week. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.